What I'd like to talk about today is a practice that I'm familiar with mostly from the Zen tradition. And though it's kind of found its way into kind of American Buddhism in a kind of a, some places a very important kind of central stage for some people. And that's the practice of not knowing. I first heard about it from the one of the first times from a Korean Zen master, who Seungsan Im, who had a habit or a teaching habit. I don't know if he still does. For a long time, of just teaching don't know, and the people who studied with him would then give Dharma talks, and they'd kind of imitate his deep Korean voice, you know, which I can't do. Only don't know, you know. You've had him getting it second, third hand now. And so the not knowing mind. It's a very effective practice, the practice of not knowing. And to get a sense of how it's effective and when to use it and how to use it, it might be useful to think about all the ways in which knowing gets in the way. Where we think we know what's going on, or we even know what's going on, and we know best. And everybody else wishes that we didn't know so well. And you kind of whisper to them, you know, they whisper to you, practice, don't know. Now? But I'm in control. I want to be in control. Yeah, that's the point. At the San Francisco Zen Center, they had a very common expression called beginner's mind. It's Suzuki Roshi taught. Very similar, the idea of being a beginner. And the teaching was that someone who was an expert in theory had all these preconceived ideas of how things are. And so they only, you know, would do things certain ways. But someone who's a beginner wouldn't know the way it's supposed to be done. And so then you could do it in a very different way. And it seemed like every time I kind of heard the news in the last few days, there was always discussion about 3 days rest. Some of you know about the three days rest thing. You need to have more than 3 days rest if you're a major league pitcher. And so, you know, there's a lot of opinions about, you know, what's supposed to be. And so... And there was this coach who's been a coach for 55 years or so, who is the expert. He was the one who said, no, we can do it in 3 days. But the not knowing mind then is a mind that doesn't come with preconceived ideas and fixed ideas. And this not knowing mind, this attitude of not knowing, can certainly be useful in big questions of life. And I've heard plenty of Buddhist teachers have been approached, and they've been asked, you know, what about rebirth? That's a big question, right? What happens to me when I die? And they say, you know, I don't know. And the ones I've heard who said that seem very comfortable in not knowing these kinds of big questions, not knowing the answers. Oh, don't know. It's almost as if those is irrelevant to what their spiritual life is about, rebirth. You know, I don't know. There's a story that's told in the Theravadin tradition of a weaver's daughter. I don't know if she has a name. But she was 16 years old the first time she heard the Buddha teach. And the Buddha taught about how important it is to reflect on death. And to think about death, to do death meditation, reflecting on death, contemplating on death a little bit. So that you kind of face your issues around death, perhaps, and face your fears and your concerns about it. And the Buddha said in this teaching that she heard was that those who contemplate death will face their own death without any fear. And so she took this to heart, and for 3 years she practiced contemplation of death. And the Buddha came back to her town when she was 19 years old, and she was in his assembly. He was about to teach, but somehow he could feel that how much she'd been changed in those 3 years. And so he asked her, so instead of teaching everybody the crowd that had gathered around, he addressed this now 19-year-old girl. And he asked her, where are you coming from? And she said, I don't know. And then Buddha said, where are you going? I don't know. And the crowd of people started getting a little bit kind of, you know, restless now. It was kind of this 19-year-old girl speaking kind of this way up to the Buddha. It didn't seem very polite, nice. And they'd come to hear the Dharma, and there was just impolite conversation. And then the Buddha says, don't you know? Or do you not know? And she says, I know. And then the Buddha says, do you know? And she says, I don't know. And then the people are really kind of getting upset, and they're beginning to deride her and criticize her for treating this great spiritual teacher in a very disrespectful way. He was asking her, you know. And so then the Buddha said, quiet down, and let me ask her further. So the Buddha asked her, when I asked you the first time, where are you from? Where are you coming from? Why did you answer? I don't know. And she said, well, I knew very well that you knew that I came from the Weaver Studio where I work. And that's not what you're asking. You were asking, where did I get reborn from? And I don't know where I was reborn from. And when I asked you, where are you going to go? Where are you going? Well, you know very well that I'm carrying this bundle of cloth that I've woven. I'm bringing it someplace. You know that. And that's not what you're asking. You're asking, where will I be reborn? And I said, I don't know. And then when I said, do you not know? Why did you say, I know? Oh, because when you said that, you were asking, do you not know that you're going to die? Because there's a way in which a lot of people don't know they're going to die. We all know, right? But this is said that a lot of people don't really take it in some profound way to really live their life knowing as if they're going to die. So she said, no, I know that. I know I'm going to die. She spent 3 years doing this contemplation of death and dying. And then when I asked you, do you know? Why did you answer, I don't know? Oh, because when you asked, do you know, this time, you're asking me if I knew when I was going to die. And I don't know when I'm going to die. That's why. So then everybody was very impressed by her and her wisdom and all that. And the Buddha taught her some more. And she attained some degree of enlightenment. And sometime soon thereafter, was struck by one of the shuttles in the loom and died. So I don't know why she had to die in the story, but you never know, right? So you have this attitude of not knowing in the big questions of life. And sometimes it can be quite profound around something like death. We don't know when we're going to die. We live as if we have, 50 years or 20 years or 10 years or whatever. We have time. And I've known people who regretted. They realized they didn't have so little time. They didn't have time to say, I love you to someone, or to take care of some final business, or to do something that felt very important for themselves because they were always putting it off. So then not knowing, to remind you, you don't really know. And then how do you take that into account as you plan your life and live your life? So it's in the big questions, not knowing, there's a place for that kind of mind, that kind of approach. But also the not knowing mind, and to not know, the practice of don't know. There's a one meditation practice, which is you sit in meditation, and every time you notice you're thinking about something, you say to that thought, you have a conversation with yourself, and you say to that thought, don't know. Don't know. I'm not having a very good time meditating today. Don't know. I think that I'm going to go afterwards to Hutterd Park and go for a hike. Don't know. I think that I need to plan my finances for the rest of my life. all these thoughts that bubble up, right? I need to fix that relationship. Don't know. I need to. Or, just everything. Don't know. don't know. It's kind of like questioning everything. The bumper sticker, it's kind of like taking the bumper sticker, question authority. And we question the authority of everything we think. Don't know. Don't know. When I was, after I'd practiced Zen for a few years, I went down to Tassajara, the Zen monastery, for the first time to be a monk there for about 3 years. And I was driving down through Carmel Valley and over the mountain to Tassajara. And then I was there for the first few days. And in that drive in the first days and the first weeks there, one of the very strong senses I had, or impressions or perceptions that I had, was that I painted everything that I saw with concepts, with ideas, with interpretations. And I would see these trees, these beautiful oak trees, or I'd see rocks, or I'd see people, or I'd see buildings. And I could see, you know, there was the building, the rock, the trees. And then I could see there was almost like there was this veil between the rock or the tree and me of my ideas of what rock is, or what tree is, or what a person is, or what a building is. And there were a lot of ideas that I was constantly doing it. And I still do it. But I had never been aware until that moment how much I was doing that. And I became kind of amazed to watch this painting, I call it painting, that was constantly going on. How much do we live in concepts and ideas of what things are, as opposed to how things actually are? How much do we live in beliefs of what we think needs to happen, rather than in really seeing what's happening in the moment? There's a famous Zen story of someone going to a Zen teacher and saying, who's an old man by now, been a teacher for many years, and I guess you probably, my imagination is a young whippersnapper kind of monk comes along who knows everything, comes along and says, you know, what is the teaching of a lifetime? So you've been teaching all these years, you know, given all these years of teaching, what is the teaching that you have for all this lifetime? How do you summarize it? What is the teaching of a lifetime? What do you have to say? And the Zen teacher says, an appropriate response. Imagine that as an answer. The teaching is the basic thing you had to teach, the teaching of a lifetime, what a lifetime of practice, was summarized in appropriate response. That somehow his expression of Zen, or his realization, was not in a teaching exactly, but in his response to any particular situation he found himself in. And you don't know ahead of time what is the appropriate response. So the summary of a lifetime of practice and teaching is in any situation you find yourself, finding the appropriate response. And so then having a not knowing mind perhaps is very important. Well, you don't necessarily know the preconceived idea, what's needed here. I've caused a lot of grief, not a lot, but a certain amount of grief, by thinking I knew what was going on. And then finding out later that I'd mistook the person. I didn't understand what was going on. Remember one of the strong times when this happened was very innocently. I was in a changing room in the restaurant where I worked, and there was a change of shifts. And I was leaving, and someone was coming. And this guy, a friend of mine, came in, and I engaged him right away with kind of jovial, kind of fun, kind of banter. And I didn't take the time to kind of, you know, to see who he was, what was going on, what was happening at that moment. And in a sense, I had this idea of who he was and from the past and our relationship and what was allowed in our relationship. And I just went into it just like that, based on history. Turned out one of his best friends had just died. And that was, you know, it didn't feel so good for him, for me to be joking with him at that moment. So, you know, to not know. And I've been very impressed once I started as an adult finding out the depths of people's suffering, that I don't know who I'm encountering. You know, maybe I had assumptions beforehand. One of the first times when this kind of struck me was after I left Tassajara, having been a monk there for 3 years, I did a weekend death and dying workshop with Stephen Levine. And it was in Marin County in the early 80s. And there were all these I don't know how to characterize them exactly, but there are all these ordinary people there. The kind of ordinary people you'd seen if you walk down the streets any place, you know. And you see them as ordinary people, you know. You just say hello, or they ask you for the directions, you'd talk to them, or, you know, you'd dismiss them, or, you know, whatever we do with people. But there is ordinary people, the kind of people I wouldn't think much about in some ways, you know, not. And then they started speaking. And, you know, some of them were dying. Some of them had their children had died recently, and parents dying. You know, all this suffering. And I was blown away that the people that I thought I kind of, I don't know, knew or kind of just treated as ordinary. What's ordinary? And, you know, so, you know, had all this suffering, all this, you know, tragedy in their life. And so the idea of not knowing when I encounter someone, I don't know who they are. I encounter someone who I've seen before. I don't know who they are. I do a lot of interviews with people. Sometimes I do interviews with the same person a number of times. And sometimes, and occasionally someone will come and want to correct a view that I have of them. You know, because last time I said, they said something to me, and, you know, they want to say, well, that was a little bit wrong then, or they want to clarify what I meant, and so you have a better view of me, or whatever. And I appreciate when people do that. But I really, kind of what I practice in interviews is, in a sense, I try to meet everyone fresh and new, and as if I don't know them. And so even though I kind of hopefully remember something of the conversation before, it's like as if I've never met the person before also. Because, like, what's here? What's new here? What's going on here? Because I don't want to carry with me the burden, oh, I know, because of some past. So, you know, I paint the world with concepts, live in that world of concepts. And is it useful sometimes to question them, to question their validity? And I believe it often is. I believe that often we don't question very deeply the authority upon which we believe something. And so almost every thought train that we have, I imagine, has some kind of implicit belief that supports that train of thought. How do we... is it possible to question the authority of the train of thought? And what knowing, what belief does it rest? So to go back again to being in the Zen monastery, one of the big lessons there for me, which I've talked often about, is working in the kitchen and being in charge of a crew of people in the kitchen and realizing how much I wanted to be liked and how much of my behavior was oriented around getting people to like me. And being a manager of people in the kitchen is not the best place to get people to like you. It's possible. But... But it's not an easy place to do it, and so it was a very stressful place to get, you know, for me to try to figure out how to get everyone to like me, and I had to kind of just, you know, and I remember one person said some years later, he said to me, he said, I need to talk to you, and he took me outside, and he said quietly, he said, you know, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out, and. But, you know, upon what authority, what belief system was I operating on where I believed it was important to have people like me? There's a belief there, right? I was operating on the belief it's important people like me. Why? Can we question that? Or at least bring to that, recognize that, and say, don't know. Don't know. Don't know if it's important people like me. Don't know if it's important to have that, for me to have that desire. And there's certainly not this neurotic desire for that to be the case. Don't know. Don't know. I find that saying that question, almost like a mantra, don't know, in response to what I think, what I believe, the things that come up, it has been a very effective way for me to create space in the mind, to open it up, to relax it. because of the how often the mind is operating on some narrow, constricted knowing, as if I know. When often that knowing is in the way, or is a problem, or holding me back, or keeping the mind contracted. So this question, this little word, I don't know. It's very, very powerful. There's another Zen story. A monk has been wandering around, kind of on pilgrimage, which Chinese monks often did. And he's taking leave of the last temple he's been at. And the Zen master asks him something like, where are you going? And the monk says, I'm going wandering around. And there's echoes in this koan with the idea of samsara, wandering around in samsara. But I'm wandering around. And then the Zen teacher says something like, and how are you going to wander around? How are you going to be as you wander around? And the guy says, I don't know. And the Zen teacher says, not knowing is most intimate. And then the guy is enlightened, as they are sometimes in these stories. But this quote, not knowing is most intimate. So it's a very, intimacy is sometimes in Zen, in Chinese Zen, is almost equated to enlightenment itself. So not knowing is very intimate, it's very precious, it's very deep. Not knowing. To meet something with a mind that doesn't know, that is open to, you know, possibility, that is not demanding situation to be a certain way, not requiring ourselves to be any kind of way, not putting limits, not contracting with our thoughts or our mind. It's a not knowing mind, a mind which is maybe spacious, relaxed, at ease with how things are, open to possibilities. Not knowing. And then the Zen master Suzuki Roshi said, not knowing doesn't mean you don't know. So it doesn't mean that you have to kind of forget everything you've known. It's not you can certainly be naively going around with a not knowing mind. But if you kind of begin recognizing all the ways in which knowing has gotten in your way, maybe there's a way of learning the art of carrying with us, the knowing we do know, but not holding it too tight, holding it lightly, so that we're ready to kind of let it be different. It doesn't have, you know, it's almost like a tentative interpretation, our knowing. Oh, maybe it's this way. Or maybe not. Let's find out. Maybe it's this way, maybe not. Let's find out. Don't know. Only don't know. It's interesting that there's a Zen teacher by the name of Bernie Glassman who started a Zen peacemaker order. So it's kind of like a new order of Buddhist monastics whose focus is to be peacemakers in the world. I'm not sure exactly all the things they do. But they have three principles, I believe, or precepts or something, three principles of how they're supposed to be peacemakers. And the three are practice not knowing, bearing witness, and healing. So those are the three aspects of Bernie's ideas of peacemaking. Entering situation with a not knowing mind, bearing witness to what's there, and then somehow offering healing in that situation. So imagine that, going without knowing, not knowing what's needed, not knowing what the appropriate response is. So I can imagine that not knowing is often a very frightening place to be. Partly people want to know because to protect themselves from being the fear, the uncertainty, the insecurity. If we know, then things are safe. There certainly is a place for knowing. Knowing is a very important aspect of Buddhist practice. But I hope that today I've conveyed a little bit the importance of not knowing, and suggest that you experiment with this practice of not knowing a little bit to see when it is useful for you. It's probably more often than you realize. But if you do it really well, try for like a few days or for a week, really carry it with you and see how deeply you can probe with this question, or this statement, don't know. Because you know, there's like layers and layers of beliefs in our mind. And so you take a statement as innocent as sitting here and thinking, you know, I need to have a Caesar salad for dinner. I need to make a, you know, that's innocent, right? Or so don't know. Don't know if you need a Caesar salad, right? But then you can keep asking, you keep saying the statement, don't know. Caesar salad. You realize, oh, the reason why you thought you needed a Caesar salad was you're having guests over and you need to impress them with your wonderful Caesar salad recipe. Do you really need to do that? Don't know. Do you need to impress your guests? Don't know. It doesn't need to be a Caesar salad. It means, or underneath that, it means that you feel like you need to be someone in relationship to someone else. You need to prepare yourself and be a certain person so when you encounter them, you know, they see you a certain way. And it manifests itself in making Caesar salad. Don't know. Don't know you need to be anybody. Who told you that? That you have to be someone. Present yourself a certain way. Where's the manual that says, you know, human being has to be this way or any kind of way or prove themselves? It says you have to be a success or you have to be a failure or you have to be this way or that way. Don't know. If you do it well for a while, you probably find it doesn't leave you with much as a basis for authority. Question authority. And you'd probably be a lot happier. And other people will be a lot happier around you. So that's about all I know for today. So anybody have any comments or questions?
I'm afraid to ask a question. I might get the I don't know thing.
Yes.
It's also interesting to see when you're sitting here during the day how many things the mind brings up that a certain thing is going to happen a certain way because the mind feels uncomfortable not knowing what's actually going to happen and the way the mind actually believes it. And I always found it useful to say, well, maybe that way, maybe not. So
we don't know how things are going to turn out, but we often orient ourselves around the belief that we know some way or other. One of my sources of wisdom has been, one of the unfortunate ways of developing wisdom is from familiarity. And unfortunate means that you have to do it over and over and over again until finally you get it, you know. But one of the ways for me was I used to worry a lot about the future and planning and, you know, how it's going to be, and I still plan to some degree, but so many times, how I planned it was going to be, you know, the event didn't even happen. They canceled the meeting, or I came to the meeting or whatever, and it was all different than what I expected it to be. And all that planning. I once spent a year planning something that didn't happen. I mean, a lot, not just, you know, casually once in a while, but like probably spent 2 hours a day. I had a lot of leisure time. And I was convinced it was going to happen. Didn't happen. So I'm a slow learner. Yes?
Well, I just want to thank you for your talk this morning. It seems very appropriate to where I am right now. And I guess a question that I've been asking myself in the last couple of weeks is the difference between control and containment. The difference between wanting to control a situation and creating a container where it can be what it is. And yet I still find container. Otherwise, things just start to feel like a really slippery slope. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So are there, like, in-between stages? Or how would you respond to that?
Well, that's a great question, the difference between control and containment. And if you're engaged in some kind of situation, it seems like something needs to be contained. But when is that controlling it? And it's a great question. It's a little bit vague. So I'll answer the best I can with what you've given me. What occurs to me is that controlling might be wanting things to be a particular way and kind of maneuvering or manipulating things to be the way you want them to be. Containment, to me, resonates with the idea of setting limits, what's allowable. So, you know, you can be the way you are up to these limits, and then I'll say no. And so it's kind of like you have the veto power. So you're not controlling the situation exactly, but you're saying, you know, within these bounds, the behavior is appropriate, but beyond that. So like with kids, that's often the case. You know, you set the boundaries, you know, you're not going to control the kids so much, but you're going to say, you know, you can't go beyond these bounds. And then there's, you know, consequences. And sometimes the mind is that way, right? Maybe you don't try to control your mind, but you have the veto power over your mind. And that's the way of containing it. Say, no, I'm not gonna say that or go there or do that. So is that, what do you think of that?
I wouldn't say I know this, but I suspect that Socrates said the realization that you don't know something is the beginning of wisdom.
Mm.
So I always liked that.
Socrates said the realization you don't know something is the beginning of wisdom. Someone said recently, maybe this is a common cliche, but I only heard it for the first time. Education is not filling a pot, it's lighting the fire. Lighting a fire. Yeah.
I have a little booklet of Zen sayings, and I'm not sure who said this, but it was, it takes a long time to learn nothing.
Did you hear that? She said that there's a Zen saying that that goes, it takes a long time to learn nothing. Right? Yes.
What do I know?
Did he have an answer? that's a great. It depends on the intonation of how it's said, right?
Yeah.
What do I know, or what do I? Yes.
Another aphorism about this goes something like. It's not what we don't know that hurts us. It's what we know and just ain't so.
Great, thank you.
I don't know who said this, but this has been our experience. If I have a study, a discipline or something, the more you know, the more it is you realize you don't know. That this is just a little piece, and there's so much more in this, and there's this vast thing, and in a sense you have to become comfortable with, you know, the way it is, and the way you may not know anything.
I've heard of doctoral students and professors at research universities like Stanford, for whom it's a problem that they're never going to know enough. Yeah.
It seems like this don't know is perhaps a path of acceptance, especially this concept of being gone this way, that way. Finding that a lot of my suffering comes from that this response, I don't even know who I am.
So perhaps not knowing is a path of acceptance because you don't even know who you are. And maybe so. Maybe it's more profound than even acceptance. Maybe there's something more profound than self-acceptance. Yes?
What resonated for me on a personal note to this talk is I'm currently trying to learn fiddle playing, and the concept of actually getting before my just being in front of that and being able to say, I don't know, and be not like, I don't know, as opposed to, I don't know, we'll find out.
I think very strongly, it's a very, very powerful practice, especially if you do it thoroughly. If you only do it, you know, if you try to do it seriously, but only do it halfway, you know, then it might leave you kind of hanging. But if you do it really thoroughly, I think it's, you know, you'll forever be changed. So, please enjoy your not knowing mind. And good luck.